Dear listeners, hello and thank you for joining us for this 246th edition of Sudbury News Talk magazine. My name is Michelle Mandry and I will be your presenter today. It's been such a relief to hear the birds chattering away and feeling the sun make a belated, if somewhat meagre, appearance, and I hope you've had a chance to enjoy it too. Our contributors had a choice of topics for this edition of the magazine. Water, for what I'm sure are obvious reasons. Or, in honour of today's guest, my year, a kind of reflection on 2025. As ever, we have a delightful mix for you of the personal and the observational. So let's dive in with a trip down memory lane from Toby Jacobs. Read by Ken Watkins.
I was born in July 1970 in the furthest reaches of South London. This might explain why I have always loved the months when the trees are full, the flower beds are in bloom, and the sun is high in the sky. Some of my most abiding memories of childhood are the family trips we made to the former Purley Way Lido in the London borough of Croydon. This behemoth of Art Deco splendour was situated opposite the site of the famous Croydon Aerodrome, where the likes of Amy Johnson and Charles Lindbergh filled the waiting crowds. We would board the single-decker 115 bus in Norbury, bound for this watery wonderland. The anticipation was palpable as we progressed down the A23. Sadly, today's Purley Way is nothing more than an artery for traffic and noise, but in the early 70s, it felt like a grand concourse leading to the promised land. Alighting at Wadden Way, it appeared we had reached the end of the line, that curious hinterland where the city peters out and the countryside slowly begins. The skies seem bigger, the grass greener, and the air sweeter. Or so we thought anyway. As we walked towards our destination, we started to hear the cries and shouts of abandon. There was a distinct odour in the air, a heady perfume, redolent of cold water on hot paving stones. Then, at last, we caught our first glimpse of it. The large 1930s administration block stretched halfway down the road. A reminder of a decade when architecture, art and design informed many public buildings, most notably Lido's. Rising up, phoenix-like, from the centre of this view, was a three-tier diving platform, a conduit to the heavens above. We finally reached the turnstiles, and with a clickety-clack we were in, participants in a world hidden from view, but accessed by those in the know. Walking up the stairs, a panorama of blue light enveloped us. Purley Way Lido was unusual in that it was a cruciform shape. It had shallow areas at both ends and a deep diving pit in the middle. Everything about it was on a grand scale. The steps down into the water were scalloped, like a 1930s Hollywood set. The aerators were like the biggest water feature you've ever seen. On the pool side, there were areas of paving, but by far the most attractive feature was the large area of grassland beyond. This is where we always set up camp. So began a day of dips and drying, shivers and frying. The glacial temperature of the water ensured all waterburn sessions were brief, but the feeling of euphoria was like nothing else. Cold water, under open skies, should be on prescription. Sadly, as the day ebbed away and the sun lowered, thoughts of home loomed. Bags were packed away, as were our memories, only to be retold 40 years later. The revival of interest in Lido's and the realisation by local authorities that having such an asset is something worth investing in came too late for Purley Way. It is now a well-known garden centre. But if you happen to be passing, take a look amongst the lobelias and petunias. You might just find something surprising rising up from the ornamental shrubs. Close your eyes, take a deep breath, and smell that Aquarian summer.
Thank you, Toby, for such a lovely reminder of the wonderful civic architecture and enjoyment Lido is used to provide. And they are mostly in the past tense, sadly. Many thanks also to Ken Watkins for reading. Next, we have Margaret King, who takes us to a distant land where she just about manages to avoid the water.
Hello. The following story is not specifically about water, but if you listen to it carefully, you will appreciate why I've written it. And you may also discover the aspect of water which invades the story towards the ending. South Africa, A Walk to Remember. A number of years ago, in fact in November 2008, we visited South Africa, taking a holiday with the Ramblers Association. It was a good time to go, as we were told that the weather would be reasonable, very pleasantly warm and not too hot. This was in fact true, although we did have a day or so of fairly heavy rain. This occurred, of course, when the coach was driving down the famous Garden Route, making it nigh on impossible to admire the scenery. But that's the luck of the draw, as they say. We had already taken a number of Ramblers holidays and were very familiar with the general setup. That is, the groups are relatively small, about 16 to 18 people, plus a leader, occasionally a couple, man and wife, partners, etc. On this trip, there was just the one leader, Rupert, a white South African who had lived for the last 45 years in Athens. He was prone to offer comparisons between the prowess of the South African ethos and the lamentable one of the Greeks, particularly in the aspect of the presentation of their public toilets. All the Ramblers knew Rupert. He was quite, let's say, flamboyant in his manner, but with the knowledge and verve to take us to some very unusual, infrequently visited places. Thus, one day, we had a meal served by the prisoners in the very prison where Nelson Mandela had been held. Later, we toured Mandela's bungalow, from where he took the long road to freedom, and afterwards admired his nearby statue. On the Sunday, we spent a fascinating hour or so in a township church, participating in the Sunday morning service. Heavy rain had transformed the roads surrounding the shack-like houses into a sea of mud, yet the large congregation, ranging from babes in arms to the very elderly, were all turned out in their smartest Sunday best attire. The boys in shirts and ties and the little girls in white net confections with bows in their shiny hair. Everyone, including us Ramblers, sang along to an eclectic mix of hymns, accompanied by guitar strumming and drum beating musicians. On another occasion, owing to Rupert's expert machinations with his given budget, he managed to secure us all an evening excursion to a beautiful revolving restaurant set on the top floor of a very tall building. As the restaurant slowly revolved and the darkness fell, the lights of Cape Town came on, illuminating Table Mountain and the city. A magical experience. However, Rupert's principal task was to lead us on long and exciting walks, to which end, when staying in the unique settlement of Maikiesfontein, he had us up at the crack of dawn to take us into the Karoo to watch the sunrise. Quite an experience ploughing over the wild bracken towards a hilltop vantage point. Some days later, our group boarded a coach, which took us to a small peninsula, if memory serves me well. Rupert led us off at a fairly brisk pace for the proposed circular walk. I did hear him mutter at the start something about concrete steps, but took no notice. The walk proved to be really good, scenic and varied. Following on from a lunch break, we found ourselves at the top of an enormous sand dune, which we descended in a swerving, random way, laughing as our feet sank into the sand. We landed on a large, secluded beach. From this point, Rupert led us upwards onto a well-trodden path along the side of a cliff face. Very easy walking. Until the path stopped at the cliff wall. We were at least 30 to 40 feet up the cliff. The path had gone and the sea was surging below in a most angry fashion. The only way across was to walk or balance over three reasonably large, semicircular concrete steps, which had been set into the cliff face. I was absolutely terrified. My legs turned to jelly, and yet I knew there was no way I could turn around and retrace the whole day's walk as we were nearing the end. In fact, the coach was awaiting us within minutes over the other side. The galling thing was that this encounter did not seem to faze the others, who all appeared to cross with gay abandon. When you're almost literally between a rock and a hard place, there's little one can do but muster up as much courage as possible. So, with some assistance from my husband and an unformulated decision not to look down, I managed to manoeuvre the three, or was it even four, concrete stepping stones successfully. I've had many a nightmare thought about it since, and it's not an experience I ever wish to repeat. However, there is a short footnote to this story. One of my best friends and her husband had taken this very same Ramlus holiday a few years previously. One day, I asked her whether they'd taken the peninsula walk terminating upon the large beach. "Oh, yes," she said, remembering other landmarks. "Did you have any problem with the cliff face and the concrete steps?" I asked. She looked very puzzled. "Concrete steps? What concrete steps?" "No, we were fine," she replied. "We just walked all around on the beach back to the coach." Then the light dawned, or rather exploded. For her walk, the tide was out. For ours, the tide was in.
Thank you, Margaret. What horror. My reaction would have been exactly the same. So well done for getting across at all and not taking John into the water with you. And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce our guest today, the Mayor of Sudbury, Andy Welsh. Andy has been kind enough to come into the studio to tell us about his year in office. Andy.
Okay, thank you. Well, firstly, I'd like to thank News Talk for inviting me to share some highlights of my year as Mayor, and I hope listeners will find it interesting. I've had a fascinating and mostly enjoyable year, during which I have discovered so much that I was unaware of about the amazing things that happen in our wonderful town, and the incredible amount of time spent by both volunteers and town hall staff to create an environment where everyone is able to enjoy it. I admit, I was initially a little apprehensive about taking on the role, but what I soon realised was that people genuinely like having a mayor and are very grateful when you turn up to support their events. I've attended a vast number of events, including civic services, choral society and Sudbury Symphony Orchestra concerts, store openings, raffle draws, AGMs of organisations like Town Twinning, and supporting special events like the opening of the new climbing wall at the Scout Hut, or the premiere of a film about the Silver Swans, a ballet group for older performers. These events brought home to me what diverse opportunities there are here for either participating in or being a spectator at local happenings. One thing that particularly struck me was the joy that dressing up in my robes and chains can bring to older citizens living in care homes. The generation they were brought up in venerated the position of mayor, and they were often overjoyed to meet one face to face for the first time. This was replicated when meeting young children as well, at events such as the mayor's Christmas card competition and the Christmas lights switch on. They were so excited to meet the mayor, and this bodes well for the future of the role. Some of my favourite duties have revolved around the Remembrance Day events and the VE and VJ celebrations. For VE Day, we had activities taking place all day throughout the town, culminating in the lighting of the beacon. The beautifully written speeches were very emotional to read, as they eloquently told the story of the bravery and suffering shown by so many to protect us, and why we must never forget what happened and allow this to happen again. Some of the more traditional and historic events were also fascinating. I was honoured to inaugurate New Freemen to Sudbury. For those who don't know, there is a historic core of freemen who were originally people where three generations had been born in Sudbury. As people moved and their children relocated, numbers have obviously reduced, but the tradition continues, and the freemen are augmented by the introduction of lifetime freemen, who are people who have made an outstanding contribution to the town over their lives. Similarly, I was delighted to hand out clothing vouchers on two occasions this year, most memorably in the mayor's parlour on Christmas morning. Sudbury Municipal Charities dates back over 400 years, when a patch of land in the town centre was bequeathed to provide food and clothing for the poor of the town. The land was sold and the money invested, very wisely it would seem, and over 400 years later the tradition continues. On Christmas morning we welcomed over 20 deserving souls into the mayor's parlour, gave them a glass of sherry and some mince pies, and distributed the vouchers, hopefully brightening their day. These are the sort of traditions that make Sudbury such a special place, and I feel honoured to have been part of it. I can't go without mentioning the visit of Catherine, Princess of Wales, to Stephen Walter's silk mill in September. I was made aware of the visit a couple of months prior, but sworn to secrecy for security reasons. I was asked as mayor to meet her and welcome her to Sudbury, and was extremely impressed by her professionalism, charisma and charm. She is often talked about in glowing terms in the press, but you can't really understand just how genuine she is until you meet her. I'm sure she will make a wonderful future queen. I'm still mayor until early May, when I'll hand over the chains to a new incumbent. During that time, I will continue to attend events, including a charity wine and cheese tasting evening on March the 17th at the Town Hall, in aid of my two charities, Prostate Cancer UK and Sudbury Defibrillators. We have already raised a lot of money for these two very worthwhile charities, but I'm obviously keen to make the most of my opportunity to support them. Information on how to book tickets is on the Town Council website. I'll also be doing a charity walk on April the 8th, following the St Edmunds Breed path from Bury St Edmunds to Sudbury Town Hall, a total distance of 26 miles. Again, details of how to sponsor are on the Town Council website. So, thank you for listening. and I hope my recollections of the year so far were of some interest. I'm immensely proud to have been mayor this year, working with a fantastic team at the town hall. This is an incredible town, with an immense number of events and activities going on for a town this size, and don't let anyone tell you different. I feel incredibly lucky to live here, and I hope you feel the same.
Thank you, Andy, for that enthusiastic and heartfelt account of your year as Mayor of Sudbury. It truly is a special town, as you say. And now I have this month's quiz for you, so get your thinking hats on. Question number one. Which has more rainfall, the Sahara or the Antarctic? Question number two. In which country would you find Jerez? Question number three. Neptune was the god of what? Question number four. Sodium chloride is better known as which condiment? Question five. In which decade was Moldy Old Dough a number one hit in the UK? Question six. In the Grand National, how many times did Red Rum win? Question seven. What is a bullus? And the last one for today, question eight. Sudbury is known to have had a market in the year 1009. Which English king happened to be on the throne at that time? How did you do? Well, we'll find out later, won't we? Jackie McSweeney is here now to recall a rather dramatic encounter with water in the most inappropriate and yet perhaps appropriate of moments. Jackie.
Thank you. This month, I'm talking about water. I love water. I drink it all the time. It's my favourite, along with tea. It's not until you don't have it that its value is appreciated. Now, bear with, this is a rather obscure introduction, but it will make sense. On the 20th of January, my husband was being cremated. There wasn't a ceremony. He requested a direct cremation, where he was sent to the crematorium and there was no service. The amazing funeral director had asked me if I would like any music to be played as he was being taken in. I hadn't expected that question, and the first song that came to my mind was Walking on the Moon by The Police. First released in 1979, my husband said that this is what he felt walking back from my place after we met in 1980. The service was to start at 9 a.m, so there I was, Spotify at the ready, with that song playing on repeat, crying and dancing around the living room, losing myself in the happy memories of our first flush of love. By the second time, Sting started, "We could live together, walking on the moon." I heard a hissing sound, a bit like a pressure cooker reaching its peak. It was coming from the kitchen, from behind the stopcock. I could see no sign of water, but I could definitely hear it. I tried to turn off the stopcock and I was stuck solid. Panic began to emerge. Do I hit it with a hammer? No, it might get even worse. I went and found the trusty toolbox. Ah, spanners, pliers, all sorts. I tried various lumps of metal, but to no avail. I still couldn't turn off the water. It was sounding like an underground river. I thought, who can I ring? Ah, Jake the plumber. He was on another job, but he said it could come later in the afternoon. Phew. He told me to turn off the mains where the meter was, but I couldn't lift the cover. Oh, Nick the nephew. He works in a plumber's outlet. He put a plumber on the line. Ooh, yes, you've definitely got a leak, he said. I can come round and help. But unfortunately, he was in Gloucester. I need to turn off that main water stopcock. desperation was setting in. I looked out the window and I couldn't believe my luck. An Anglian water van was parked in the lane. Out I trotted, red-faced and snotty-nosed. I must have looked a bit stressed after the poor chap explained that he hadn't been playing with water pressure and was fixing a leak at another house. He offered to come in and help. "Ooh," he said. "You've got a major leak going on under the floor," he said. He easily turned off the kitchen stopcock. The water didn't stop hissing at us. The police were singing our song, the music wafting in from the living room. "Where's your main stopcock?" he asked. "Back garden." Out we went. He had his handy tool in the side trouser pocket, flipped up the cover and turned off the water. The hissing stopped. I could still hear Sting singing. "We could walk together, walking on the moon." Andy, my husband, hated water where it shouldn't be, to the point of obsession. Even a few drops on the kitchen floor would cause a comment. Now, a major leak. What would he think? I calmed as the leak had stopped and went and bought some fresh bottles of water to drink. Jake the plumber rang. He couldn't come until the next day. "No problem. I had water to drink and enough in the tank to last overnight." I rang Andy the builder, who was coming the following morning, just to put him in the picture. That evening, I sat and let my mind settle. I'd panicked a bit, but I'd also been lucky with a guy from Anglian Water who immediately helped. I was also getting a visit from the plumber and the builder the following day, so I knew a solution was coming. I decided my Andy had sent me a sign with that leak. He hated water on the floor. He was telling me to get on with the kitchen rebuild. The next day, Andy the builder came. He made a big hole in the kitchen floorboards and found the leak. Unfortunately, Jake the plumber, after visiting later, had found the leak was from the main lead pipe feeding the house. A lot more digging and flooring removed, parts were ordered, reordered, and after a very long week, all was fixed and I had running water back. Every day I had to turn the main stopcock off, run into the kitchen, get down on my hands and knees and hold my fingers over the gushing leak to fill up the water tank. How grateful I was to have cold running water restored. It's so taken for granted, just turning on the tap and out comes one of the essentials for all of our existence. We drink it, cook with it, keep our home clean and do our laundry with it, wash and brush our teeth with it, and the ability to flush the toilet is such a luxury that cannot be appreciated until you can't. Water makes a house safe, clean and livable. Without it, daily life, even for a week, was not impossible, but an experience I wouldn't relish again. Oh, but I did. Because after I got the sign from Andy to crack on and finish the kitchen upgrade, that's exactly what I've been doing for the last couple of months, with and without running water. It'll all be worth it in the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. Our next item was written by Margaret Hibble. Margaret is not able to join us, unfortunately, and so I will be reading for her. Water. Obviously, water is important in so many ways, but to me, it is of paramount importance in my garden. To me, water is useful, but also gives a lot of pleasure. We try to grow our own fruit and vegetables, but depend heavily on water to keep our crops healthy and thriving. Last summer was so hot and dry that everything all but dried up in the heat. We have three large water butts in various parts of the garden, but despite being careful with how much water we used, our supply soon ran out. I felt so sorry for our farmers when I thought, if I was struggling, how much harder must it have been for those who were trying to grow crops to sell and feed us all? As we approach another summer, we wonder what the weather has in store for us and our crops. This winter has been so wet that my water butts are full to overflowing, so we can but hope. Another use of water in my garden is to fill my bird bath. I have three and love to watch the birds as they drink, and even better, I love to watch them bathing. The sparrows are so amusing as they splash together like children playing in a paddling pool. When they have had enough fun, they hop out, sit in the sunshine, and flap their wings as they dry out. One of the bird baths has a small solar fountain in it, and the sound of trickling water adds to the pleasure. Finally, the other main use of water in my garden is to fill my small pond. A few years ago, my son-in-law spotted the old butler sink full of succulent plants. That old sink would make a lovely pond, was his suggestion. A few weeks later, the succulents happily rehoused, my son-in-law, with help from my husband, installed the very heavy sink into a border close to the patio doors. They sealed the plug hole to make it watertight and put a pile of large stones in one corner to give birds safe access into the water. Next, the new pond was filled with water before placing plants in special pots together with floating oxygenating plants. I've had so much pleasure watching the birds and insects that stop for a drink and watching the frog that quickly took up residence under the pile of stones. I have planted ferns and small spring flowers around the pond, helping it to sit happily in the border. As I write this, the sun is warm in the garden and the early flowers are releasing their perfume. Spring is here at last. Thank you, Margaret. May your water butts be filled all summer with just enough and not a drop more of nighttime rain. Here now is John King with an account of parts of his year in 2025.
There was a choice of subjects for this article: water, broadly interpreted, or the year just passed, namely 2025. To be honest, I had enough of water so far this year, as almost constantly been falling from the grey, miserable skies. In many ways, it was difficult to love much of 2025, but at least it was pretty good summer, and so it was possible to get out far away from the news and see the more gentle aspects of life without being constantly reminded of buckets full of man-made misery. Please excuse the man-made, it's not sexist, but the way our language is mainly spoken, so it sounds a bit more normal than human-made. There again, it could be interpreted as, you girls get no blame. Being in the older age bracket, I am very aware that I'm not invited to attend many weddings. In truth, I cannot remember the last one that I went to. Christenings are long in the past, which brings me to that other great gathering event, which is, of course, funerals. Death can and does strike at any age, but at the age of my contemporaries, well, it's common indeed. This actually is quite a happy thought, as the death of a young person is so sad, but death at old age is expected. In August, my wife and I attended a get-together with a group of ex-works colleagues. This is a twice-yearly event, once around Christmas time and one in the summer. There's an age range of the attendees and a few health issues, but all seem fine, with the gathering in good spirits. So a very enjoyable and convivial time passed the summer afternoon, with appetites and thirsts well sated. Then, in September, one particularly fit and alert tennis-playing member of the group phoned me and dropped a bombshell. He had been diagnosed with terminal pancreatic cancer. He had suffered few symptoms, but just a bit of tired at times. We kept in touch by phone as he did not live close at hand. Unbelievably, for the first 6 weeks, he had no pain. But his appetite diminished and his energy levels dropped. Let's say it got progressively worse and he died just before Christmas, a time of celebrations of birth. We now progress towards Easter, the event following the famous death. I'm not in the slightest bit interested whether or not you're believers. The point is, birth and death are as normal as fresh shoots in spring and the withering plants of winter. So it's best to always do well with people if you can and enjoy life while you have it, if conditions allow you to do so. My colleague certainly did. He was a confirmed atheist, so his funeral was devoid of any religion. But like him, it was pragmatic, not miserable, and people with some of his more famous ways of looking at things. One of the things he said a few weeks before the palliative drugs stifled his brain was, "I may be wrong about life after death. If I am, I'll do my best to let you know." Well, that was him. He would hate us to be miserable and much rather we kept critical eye on things and kept our laugh muscles in good shape. That was just an atom of the world that affected a minuscule proportion of the vast population in 2025. And like any other year at the fundamental level, compare this, however, with 1914-18 or the 1940s, even Ukraine today, or now the mass destruction and death in the Middle East, as it all seems rather parochial and domestic, does it not? And this year, better ask Mystic Meg or Notre Dame.
Thank you, John. You always manage to get to the heart of the matter. Julie Thompson here is here now to share the delights of a snapshot in time in 2025.
I'm going to concentrate on my highlight of 2025, and I apologise in advance for being one of those people that can't stop talking about a holiday they've been on. But honestly, in 2025, my husband and I went on the best holiday ever. When you arrive in another country, the least you can do is to learn a few words of their language. And this is the first word I used. Konnichiwa. Can you guess where we visited? Japan! And we arrived on our 14th wedding anniversary in May last year. A trip to a country so totally different from any others we've been to, and it really made us aware of changing our travelling behaviour in a way that no other country ever has. Europe, Australia and the USA, all of these places understand or speak English, and you see the same old coffee shops, fast food outlets and supermarket brands as you see back home in Blighty. But Japan, now that really does need some planning. Because it turns out that a 14-hour flight away is a place so unusual, with a language so different, and where the text is illegible to the Roman alphabet readers that we are. And like many countries, English isn't spoken by everyone. But that won't stop a local rushing over to help you the minute you stop and look at your map. Most carry, at their own expense, an electronic gadget which they speak into and it translates what they've said into English. Then you speak back into it and it does the same in reverse. We called it a Babel fish for the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy fans amongst you. And what a helpful thing to invent just to help out a lost British tourist. But this wasn't the reason we fell in love with Japan. It wasn't just its kind, helpful and polite people, the beauty of the countryside or the brilliant buildings. But as there's a time limit on this article, I've managed to drill it down to just six things. Are you ready? Number one. There's no litter. In fact, there's hardly any bins because everyone takes their litter home with them. Number two, the people have impeccable manners, although I'm sure there could be a few bad apples, but we never met them. Number three, the population's consideration for those around them. For example, mobile phone usage in public places. Can you believe that there are signs requesting that those using headphones be aware that the noise leaking from them may disturb others and adjust their volume accordingly? Number four, the food is absolutely amazing. Chopsticks are the norm, small plates of beautifully prepared food, deliciously fragrant and just so unusual to our Western palate that you savour each and every mouthful. Number five, bullet trains. Wow, they look so space age. There are marked areas to wait on the platform, depending on which carriage and seat number you have reserved. This enables those getting off the train to do so unimpeded by those waiting to get on. Quite important when the stop time is just 2 minutes. There's lots of room around your seat and unbelievably, they move at almost 200 miles per hour. And the ride is so smooth that a full drink on your tray table doesn't spill. And number six, finally, the toilets. Now, I won't go into specifics. Okay, I will. Whether you're in a posh hotel or a train station, the loo seats are self-cleaning and they are heated when you sit down. A little speaker in the wall fills the cubicle with the sound of waterfalls, although I'm not sure if this was to encourage or to hide any unfortunate sounds. I won't go into any more detail about what happens at the end, but needless to say, if you move to Japan, you'll never need to buy toilet paper again. So next time you're thinking about holiday destinations, remember the best thing that happened to me in 2025 and add Japan to your list. Sayonara.
Thank you, Julie. It sounds like you had the most marvellous time in Japan, though I'm very grateful that your item stopped where it did. And now back with those quiz answers you've been waiting for. One, which has more rainfall, the Sahara or the Antarctic? Surprisingly, the Sahara has more rainfall than the Antarctic. Two, in which country would you find Jerez? I should probably have spelt that for you. It's J-E-R-E-Z. The country, I'll give you a second, is Spain. And it's the place in which sherry originated. Three. Neptune was the god of what? Neptune is, or was, the Greek god of the sea. Four. Sodium chloride is better known as which condiment? That would be salt. Sodium chloride is the chemical name for salt. Are you detecting a theme yet? Five. In which decade was Moldy Old Dough a number one hit in the UK? And that would be the 1970s, where it was a hit for Lieutenant Pigeon, as Dave, our technician, so correctly identified. Six. In the Grand National, how many times did Red Rum win? And that would be three. In 1973, 1974, and 1977. Seven. What is a bullace? Yep, I think a couple of people got it right in the studio. A bullace is a type of plum. And finally, Sudbury is known to have had a market in the year 1009. Which English king happened to be on the throne at that time? And contrary to rumour, John King wasn't around then. So it was King Ethelred the Unready. And I forget now what he was unready for, but it was probably the Danes or something. So how did you do? 8 out of 8? I'm sure it was. And finally, closing today's magazine is Ken Watkins with his experience of weather in the West and Wales.
When the topics for this month's magazine appeared in my emails, I was half listening to the sound of rain pouring down once again, so couldn't resist a wry smile. In Wales, we're quite accustomed to wet weather, although I'd like at the outset to dispel the myth that it always rains this side of the border. Mind you, given the amount of rain we've had here over the winter, it's a little harder to defend that point of view. But having lived here for the last 5 years, holidayed in the country several times in the past, and previously lived in Barry for 7 years, back in the 1970s and 1980s, I can assure you that we do get to see the sun on a fairly regular basis. Throw in my time at university in Bangor, North Wales, and I've lived in the country for around 15 years all told. And in those different times, I've experienced all kinds of weather here, from heat waves to blizzards and large snowdrifts, with liberal helpings of everything in between. My wife Judy is Welsh, from Barry, and we met at university. After we were married and living and working in England, we visited the family in Wales 2 or 3 times a year. One thing we always noticed, even more so when we were travelling there from East Anglia, where we lived from 1985 to 2020, was how, in the summer, the colour of the fields changed the further west we went. Starting out as light brown in the Sudbury area, the fields gradually went through several shades of green, from very light to dark and luscious, or lush, as they call it in Gavin and Stacey land, dry in the east, moist in the west. And yet, when Great Britain suffered a severe drought in 1976, one of the area's hardest hit, where standpipes had to be erected in some of the towns and villages, was South Wales. Fortunately, we weren't living there at the time, but we certainly got to hear about how difficult life was when nothing appeared as you turned on the taps. Up in Lancashire, where I was working in 1976, it was hot, very hot and uncomfortably humid at times, but we had no problems with the water supply. We moved to Barry 1 year later, 1977, and 5 years after that, in 1982, South Wales experienced another weather problem, blizzard conditions and deep snowdrifts. I was working nights on the Western Mail's sports desk in Cardiff, and we weren't aware of the conditions until we came out of the office at 1:30 in the morning to drive home. I managed to get home by following a slow-moving van most of the way back, religiously staying in its tyre tracks, but then couldn't get into work for 2 days because the drifts blocked our road and hit public transport. One colleague, who lived in a small village, was snowed in for 2 weeks. Hedges on both sides of the single road leading there, ensuring the drifts were piled high and the village needed digging out. And of course, when the thaw set in, there was plenty of water around in the fields and on the roads, and it took a long time to clear. It's been a similar picture this winter, although we haven't had any snow on the coast just yet, fingers crossed. But the almost incessant rain has meant many fields in the Vale of Glamorgan are partly or almost totally underwater, and some roads in the town have suffered flooding, though thankfully not very deep. When I first started to jot down some ideas for this talk, the weather forecast was predicting a couple of dry days for South Wales, followed almost inevitably by several wet days. 2 days of largely blue skies gave us the opportunity to assess what needed attending to in the garden, which, fortunately, is not very large. Not that I'm a big fan of gardening, but perhaps I should be grateful that with the ground so wet after some 50-plus days of rain, varying from drizzle to deluge, weeding around the edges of the garden proved much easier than many previous years. But there are still a lot of weeds to go at, so we need more than just 2 or 3 fine days so the ground can get drier and a little firmer. Maybe next month?
Thank you, Ken, and I hope the weather's dry a little at least. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this March magazine as much as I have. My thanks to our guest, Andy Welsh, Mayor of Sudbury, all of our volunteers for their contributions, to our technician, Dave Sullivan, and to you for listening. Until next time, goodbye.